discuss a little background about what brought Prabhupada here, back to Vrindavan, in order for him to establish the temple. As you know, Prabhupada had left in 1965, August 13th. He left Calcutta on the Jaladuta to come to America. And he arrived a month later after suffering two heart attacks. So from 1965 up until 1967, Prabhupada worked very hard to establish the budding ISKCON in America. Then unfortunately in January 1967, Prabhupada suffered a stroke. He became half paralyzed. And he underwent some recovery in America. But by summertime, he felt that what he really needed was to come back to Vrindavan for the heat of the summer. Everyone tries to escape the heat, but for Prabhupada, he understood that that heat would be therapeutic for him. In America, it's very cold, especially where he was in New York and New Jersey. So he boarded a plane. He said goodbye to his few disciples from San Francisco. And from New York, he had established two temples by then. And they didn't know that if they would ever see Prabhupada again. So when he came back here, he was only accompanied by one disciple, Kirtanananda. Kirtanananda was one of the first friends of Hayagriva who had met him when they were down in Greenwich Village. And unfortunately, he couldn't take initiation at the first initiation because he was trying to avoid the draft at that time in the 60s. Many of the male devotees were being forced to enter the army to fight in the Vietnam War. So some of them were able to get what was called conscientious objection, which meant that because of their religious beliefs, or their not even religious, but their conscience beliefs, they couldn't engage in war. But Kirtanananda, they weren't convinced that he was eligible to be exempted from the draft. So he went on the premise that he was not sane. So because he said that he wasn't mentally fit to be in the army, they put him in a place called Byberry in New York. It's an insane asylum. So at the first initiation, he couldn't attend because he was getting out of the draft by being in the insane asylum. So Prabhupada took this disciple, Kirtananda, with him as his assistant or nurse. It's just someone to take care of him. And the devotees here in Vrindavan were quite impressed that Prabhupada had brought back this brahmachari. And Kirtananda, because of his sincerity at the time, Prabhupada awarded him sannyas when they were staying there at Radha Damodar. And then on the way back to America, when Prabhupada was feeling strong again, Prabhupada left him in London and told him to start preaching there. But he wasn't able to do that, so secretly he went back to America and started the New Vrindavan project. So when Prabhupada went back to America, still it was 1967, and he continued with his preaching there. And occasionally, at one point, Prabhupada had to go to Montreal because he was just on a tourist visa and he had to immigrate into America. So he had sent devotees to Montreal and he went to stay with them. And for a few months he stayed there and directed the Krishna consciousness movement from there. Now, when he was in Montreal, he decided to send, he called three Grihastha couples to go to London. And anybody know who they are? Shamsundar? Mukunda? Mukunda and Janaki, Shamsundar and Malati, and Gurudas and Jamuna. So he called them to Montreal, and began training them how they could be successful in London. Specifically, he trained them in kirtan, and then he sent them there to London. Eventually, Prabhupada was able to return to America. He came to New York, to his place at 26 Second Avenue. And from that time onward, Prabhupada was very interested in spreading Krishna consciousness, not just in America, because he felt he had a foothold there. Then he had a center in Canada, then in London. He had sent Shivananda to Germany. Then he wanted to spread all over the world. So he began sending his disciples to Asia, to Australia, Malaysia, everywhere he could where the disciples were willing to go. In 1969, he sent Sudama and Balimardhan to Japan for the first time. That was the first attempt in Asia. Now, in 1970, something rather extraordinary happened in America, which catapulted Prabhupada's second return to India. What had happened was, we had some strong temples then in 1970, and we also had some strong leaders. And Prabhupada was just on the verge of creating his GBC. They were the first 12 GBC to oversee the preaching affairs throughout the world. And he also created four sannyasis at that time. That was Brahmananda, Gargamuni, Vishnujan, and Subal. Now somehow or other, the sannyasis began to misunderstand Prabhupada's position as spiritual master. And they began to equate Prabhupada as being non-different from Krishna. In other words, some Mayavad philosophy had crept in. And this depressed Prabhupada very much. So as Brahmananda was describing yesterday, Prabhupada was in Los Angeles, and it was in Los Angeles that Prabhupada gave sannyas to the four candidates, and then he sent them out preaching. But Prabhupada detected that there was a philosophical error in their preaching, and this made him very depressed. So because of this misunderstanding, the sannyasis began preaching Mayavad philosophy to the devotees. And they began treating Prabhupada on the same level as Krishna. Now Prabhupada understood, he explained to the devotees that this is very dangerous, because if you think your spiritual master is Krishna, that means when you become spiritual master, you'll also become Krishna. And the other thing that he explained, that the real way to see the spiritual master is a representative of Vyasadeva. Now some scholars believe that Vyasadeva isn't even one person. This is other Mayavad philosophy. They think that Vyasadeva is just a post, and whoever sits and speaks the philosophy of the Vedas is called Vyasadeva. But according to the true Vedic scholars, they understand that Vyasadeva was the literary incarnation of Krishna, and he created hundreds of thousands of slokas in the Vedas that he wrote down, because the people's mental stability was becoming less, so they couldn't remember everything. So the spiritual master is the representative who gives the message of Srila Vyasadeva. And that is why the Vaishnavas honor the spiritual master on the birth date of their spiritual master, which is called Vyasa Puja. And the Mayavadis, this is a distinction between Mayavad and Vaishnav, the Mayavadis, they honor their spiritual master, all of the spiritual masters, on Guru Purnima, which is the first Purnima of Chaturmas, which is coming up in 2 months. So, Prabhupada didn't know what to do about this dilemma, and in duress means he was feeling pain and difficulty, Prabhupada very quietly left America. This was in July of 1970. He just left. And the four sannyasis took that leaving to mean that all of the devotees had created a great offense, and therefore Krishna in the form of Prabhupada was leaving them. And they began to preach like that. And this upset Prabhupada even more. Now, where did Prabhupada go? He went to Japan. And from Japan, Prabhupada then decided, he wrote letters, and he began to explain to those disciples who were still understanding him properly, his faithful disciples, that he now wanted to start a new phase of his missionary activities. And that was, he wanted to bring Krishna consciousness back to India. So who did he contact? He contacted his sincere disciples who he had sent to London, specifically Jamuna and Gurudas, Shamsundar and Malati. By that time, Mukunda and his wife was having difficulty in living in ashram life, so they were heading back to America, although Mukunda was trying to get the place from George Harrison. Mukunda had to stay on to look after things in London. But the four others, Prabhupada wrote to them, and Gurudas told me about this. He wanted now to start what he called the World Sankirtan Party. So Prabhupada started writing to all of his fledgling temples around the world, and he had just created the 12 GBC members. They had their first meeting, Janmashtami of 1970, in New Vrindavan. And he asked all of the GBC members and temple presidents that I want one man sent from each of the temples to be a member of my World Sankirtan Party. So all of the temples were very small. For instance, in our temple we only had four devotees. But somehow or other, each one of the temples, there were 15 temples in America at the time, each of our temples had to provide one brahmachari for Prabhupada. And somehow or other we did it. And we sent them all to India. They all went on one chartered plane that landed in Egypt. And you can read about this in Giri Rajswami's book, because he was the leader of the party. He was the brahmachari who was sent from Boston. And they all landed in Bombay. And then from Bombay, they met Prabhupada, and they started this World Sankirtan Party. That was 1970. So Prabhupada had come from Japan's side. He landed in Calcutta, and his first mission was to get something in Mayapur and something in Vrindavan. And he also wanted to get something in Bombay. So those were his three main prerogatives in starting his preaching mission in India. So he sent Jaipataka, who was a brahmachari at that time, to Mayapur. They found some land that was owned by a Muslim farmer, and a negotiation was made, and they got the land where our temple is now being built there, the Vedic planetarium. That was the original land. Now, Prabhupada was traveling all over India with this World Sankirtan Party. It was a group now of 40 devotees. They were going to Amritsar, they were going to Gorakhpur, they went all over Gujarat. Finally, they came to Vrindavan for the first time. And this is the first time Prabhupada had returned to Vrindavan since 1967 with his one disciple. So 1971, Prabhupada comes back as the town hero. I'll read to you a little description. The Vrindavan municipality honored Prabhupada and his Western disciples with a formal reception at town hall. You know where town hall is? It's the Nagarpalika. Gopal Ghosh, that was a very dear friend and follower of Prabhupada. This is his description. Many gentlemen of Vrindavan, the principals of the colleges in Vrindavan and Mathura, and the chairman, Ramesh Chandra Sharma, offered flower garlands to Prabhupada. Huge Sankirtan was also performed with dancing. That was Prabhupada's dancing white elephants. Prabhupada sat on a big pillow under an umbrella with a devotee, while a devotee fanned him with a chamara. Prabhupada gave a lecture on Namabash. He said that Ajamil had called his son Narayan and went to Vaikuntha. So these people, my Western disciples, are always chanting the holy name of Krishna. If the name is divine and true, then through the grace of the name, they will become pure and go back home to Lord Krishna's place. So in that way, Prabhupada was reaching out to the residents of Vrindavan, that although these are foreigners, mleches, yavanas, you please accept them because they're chanting the name of Krishna. And if a sinful person like Ajamil, who is so fallen, was able to go back to Vaikuntha by calling out the name of Narayan, then certainly my disciples, who are fallen, by chanting the name of Krishna constantly, are being purified as well. So you could understand Prabhupada's logic in explaining that. Then it was the turn of the municipality to honor Prabhupada. This is a translation. They had spoken in Hindi. O great soul, today we, the inhabitants of Vrindavan, known as Brijbasis, are combinedly offer our humble welcome to your holiness in this holy place of Vrindavan. And in doing so, feel very proud. For many years you stayed at the Radha Damodar temple and worshipped Her Majesty Srimati Radharani in a meditative mood. And thus you now have the transcendental vision to deliver the entire world. As proof of your perfection, we can see this, these foreign disciples before us, and we feel very proud to see how you have transformed them into such pure devotees. We take it for granted that you are one of us in Vrindavan. We are sure that wherever you travel, you must carry with you the impression of Sri Vrindavan Dham. The culture, religion, philosophy, and transcendental existence of Sri Vrindavan Dham travel with you. Through the great message your holiness carries, all the people of the world are now becoming very intimately related with Vrindavan Dham. We are certainly sure that through your preaching alone, the transcendental message of Vrindavan will spread all over the world. So this is amazing. This is the municipality, the chairman of Vrindavan, praising Prabhupada like that, and also praising him for bringing the foreigners for the first time to Vrindavan. Now, it was with this welcome that there was a surge of appreciation of Prabhupada. And the devotees would do sankirtan throughout the streets here at Loy Bazaar. It was very different in those days, just a small town. And Prabhupada was getting a lot of, not only appreciation, but he was getting offers of help. For instance, the Maharaj of Bharatpur. Anyone has seen the palace in Bharatpur of the Maharaj? Very big. He was very powerful until the government took everything away from him. For instance, the whole town of Deeg. Have you seen Deeg? Deeg, that was the summer and the winter palace of the Maharaj of Bharatpur. And the way that was built was they had attacked the Maharaj of Agra, taken all the marble from there and built Deeg that way. So the Maharajas, before all their power was taken away, they were very powerful and they had many residences. So one of the family members, Lakshmi Rani, she had built a private palace right on the Jamuna, that's at Keshigat. And the Maharaj of Bharatpur, who had practically lost everything to the government, he was interested in selling off the rest of his properties to make money for his family so he could continue living luxuriously. So he had offered to donate the Lakshmi Rani Kunj Palace to Prabhupada. and he invited the devotees to come and live there. Before that, they were all staying at the Radha Damodar quarters on the roof, and they were staying in the Saraf Bhavan, which is now it's been torn down. It's where that Shubham is, you know, on the way at Kishorpura. So this was a great offer, and the devotees went and stayed there. And Prabhupada tried to have Gurudas negotiate that when was the Maharaj going to donate that palace to him. But the Maharaj was very elusive when he was going to donate it, and he kept avoiding the subject more and more until Gurudas finally realized he actually wanted to sell the palace to Prabhupada. So that offer fell through, and the devotees were kicked out of the palace. And then another offer came, and that was from very nice Marwari husband and wife, Kashi Prasad Sharaf and Gita Devi Sharaf. Now they had this property, and this property at the time was just, it was 5 miles, that's like how many kilometers, 5 miles? It's about 6 kilometers from the center of town, 8 kilometers. It was far. We couldn't even get rickshaws to come here in those days. But they had this nice property, and Gurudas explained to me once that, and it was a fact, before all of this construction, this road here was the most beautiful road in all of Vrindavan. It was tree-lined, it was full of beautiful old ashrams on both sides, the peacocks, there were deer and nilgai. Where the Saraf hospital is, across the street there was a dense forest there with wild animals. It was just like the way you read about Vrindavan. The tigers were there, the wild cats would come here, the nilgai were, if you just went in the morning times, you could see the nilgai there. It was actually Vrindavan here. You could see it. So they offered this land to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, he didn't want to be cheated a second time. So he made sure that the deed was signed. And even at the time of the deed signing, it turned out that the husband, he only wanted to give a portion of the land. So we've told this story many times. I'm sure you can all tell the same story back. How he wanted to keep the front portion of the land and only gave this back portion of the land to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada accepted it. That's why the temple was built just to a particular spot. And then all in the front, it was empty there. Prabhupada had us, he had fountains built there where the samadhi is now. Fountains, and then we made gardens there. We put kadamba trees and bokul and all different types of trees there to make a beautiful entrance into the temple. But we weren't allowed to construct anything there because the land didn't actually belong to us. So Prabhupada was very tricky for Krishna. And while the husband was away one day, he had gone to Guwahati where his business is, he called Gita Devi to his garden here, and he convinced Gita Devi to sign over the front portion of the land. It's 1976, we're going ahead a little bit. So, in other words, at this time, 1971, this is laying the foundation of how we got this temple. Because 1971, the offer was made by the Sarafs. She signed over the land. All of you know the story of her deities, how they made the decision? For those who don't know it. You don't know it, okay. Well, Gita Devi Saraf, her husband was quite elderly. She's still alive. She was here yesterday. She comes often. She was a young 15-year-old girl when she was married, and she was a very devoted Vaishnavi. She loved Radha and Krishna. And for her children, she had no children. She had beautiful Radha Kunja Bihari deities. And she had arranged for 24-hour kirtan for her deities in her home that's been going on for 40, 50 years now. And they lived in a place called Govindabagh, which is behind Loy Bazaar. It's where most of the merchants live, the Marwaris and people. They had a big house, and on the first floor they had their deities, a beautiful throne, and the six women, 24 hours a day, would be chanting kirtan to them. And she and her husband lived there. Now, many people knew about this land, and many spiritual organizations wanted this land. For instance, next door, now we don't have the problem because she's also passed away, but if you just go around the corner here, there's the Shama Ma Ashram, and she later built the Govardhanath Temple right on the main road. So Shama Ma, she wanted this land because it was right next to her ashram, right around the corner. And then there was a Vedanti Swami, he wanted it also. He used to come and cook in the ground floor of the Saraf Bhavan, and he would never ask for anything, but still they would come and give him something. So finally he expressed to Mr. Saraf one day that what he was coming for was he wanted this land also. So when the Sarafs finally decided to give this land to Prabhupada, the other contenders were very upset, and even they became violent. When we had our groundbreaking ceremony and put Sheshanaga in the ground, one of them even sent dacoits and dug it up and made it all dirty, and you know, made it unholy, you know. So it was a fight. So finally the Sarafs didn't know what to do, and Prabhupada was out of India at the time, so he sent Kiradakshayi Vishnu, who was the president of our temple at the time, although it didn't exist. He was made the president, Gurudas was made the vice president, and Jamuna was the secretary. That was the signing of the deed time. There was no typewriter, so Jamuna had to write the whole deed out by hand, and they signed it all. So Kiradakshayi Vishnu went to Gita Devi and asked her to fulfill her promise to give the land, and she said, well, I don't know what to do because these other people are troubling us now, so I'm going to leave the decision up to Radha Kunja Bihari. So she took a piece of paper and she wrote yes on one piece of paper and folded it up, and she took a piece of paper and wrote no, not in English, she doesn't speak English, in Hindi. And she folded that up and took the two pieces of paper and put it at the feet of Radha Kunja Bihari. And she told Kiradakshayi Vishnu to pick one piece of paper. And he picked the paper and they opened it up and, huh. Yes. So that was actually how, by the mercy of Radha Kunja Bihari, we received this land. That was the final decision. After that, she never turned back. Gita Devi. So this was 1971, the land was confirmed, the deed was signed, and we now had the land. Prabhupada sent an urgent message that, alright, now we have to make the boundary wall. So he wanted the devotees, and that wall is still here, he wanted them to put a 12-foot high wall. Now at the time, here, no wall was over 3 or 4 feet. It wasn't like it is now with everybody compounded in and the narrow streets. Everything was open, the peacocks, everyone could look into everybody else's backyard easily here. There was no fear of anything. And then suddenly Prabhupada wanted this 12-foot high wall because he could understand that once we started constructing, people were going to start to get greedy and envious. So we had them put the wall, and I remember them building the wall. We were so poor at the time. The wall just has dirt in between, single brick, and then they had the pillars in between to keep the wall up, and then on the outside they would just put a little bit of cement to keep it a little sturdy. So that was as much as we could afford to get this 12-foot wall up all around. But inside there was nothing. We had no construction whatsoever. So they built some mud huts, which were right over here, all along this wall. They built the mud huts, and that was where the construction devotees lived. Prabhupada had sent two brahmacharis from London, Gunarnava and Smarahari. What were their qualifications? Nothing. They wanted to come to Vrindavan, and they had done a little construction work in England. So on that, Prabhupada immediately sent them here. Prabhupada was really working with just spiritual energy. As Brahmananda explained, our architect wasn't even an architect, that's Saurabh. He was just a draftsman, you know. But he was able to create this. Not only did he create this design, but he created the design for our Hyderabad temple and the design for our Bombay temple. So that's the power of the spiritual master. When he wants something done, Krishna gives the intelligence how to get it done. So he came here with his wife, their little child, baby Kishori, little Kishori, and started the construction. Now, how was the construction going to be financed? Prabhupada had a plan. He had some more sannyasis who had come also part of this World Sankirtan party. Some of the brahmacharis who came here, one of them was named Guru Kripa. He was sent from San Francisco. And Yashoda Nandan, that was another brahmachari. So he made them into sannyasis, and he told them to go out and collect money. And he told them to get, I believe it was $10,000 a month. Which was, nobody could figure out how they're going to collect $10,000 a month. Maybe he said $100,000, I don't remember. But somehow they went to Japan and they began their collections. And you'll see, Prabhupada even had a big plaque put on the back of the temple, if you've noticed, where they sell the deity photos. Along that wall, the top there, are their two names, Guru Kripa Swami and Yashoda Nandan Swami, because they collected the major portion, let's say 75% of everything required to build the temple. Aside from that, also in 1970, Prabhupada established the BBT. Before that it was called the ISKCON Press. It was in Boston. It was Satsarup Maharaj and a few other devotees. They had gotten their first machine and they were producing the books in Boston. And then they got a better facility in Brooklyn, New York, so they moved the ISKCON Press to New York. And we were doing the books there. Prabhupada was sending his tapes and we were producing the books from New York. But then Prabhupada created the BBT and he made three trustees. And he decided that with this BBT, 50% would go to construction and 50% would go to more book publication. He said absolutely none of the money could go for eating and sleeping. So the second number on that plaque is the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. I think they gave 17 lakhs or something like that. So it was that institution of the BBT that Prabhupada put aside 50% and they were also sending the money. So that was number two. Then there was collection here within India, which was quite difficult. There was Tejas, who was the temple president in Delhi. Now not only did he have to collect for here, he also had to collect to establish the Delhi temple. And it was very tough. But still he would give his allotment, send as much as he could each time. And then Prabhupada himself was sending money. So if any of you have read the Lilamrita, you've read the stories about how Saurabh would go and ask Prabhupada, he'd give a detail of all the money that he needed, and Prabhupada would give him the money. And then he asked Saurabh once, well, if I send this by mail, how much does it cost to send a registered letter? In those days it was 1 rupee and 25 paisa. And then he said, and how much does it cost to go by rickshaw to, no, it was the other way around, 75 paisa for a registered letter and 125 by rickshaw. So when Prabhupada heard that it was going to cost 50 paisa more for Saurabh to take the draft by rickshaw, he decided to mail it. That's how careful Prabhupada was with all this money. Although the draft was for over 1 lakh or 3 lakh rupees, he was concerned about saving even 50 paisa. So this was all for construction, but he had instructed Gurudas and Jamuna that for all the deity paraphernalia, they had to collect themselves. Now that was very difficult. For instance, now, if we want to get a set of deity outfits made, do you know how much it costs to get a set of deity outfits made? You can...
1.5 lakhs.
That's 150,000 rupees. So Jamuna had arranged with a Mukutwala here named Lalit Prasad to make an outfit. This outfit for the deities was going to cost 3,000 rupees. And they asked Prabhupada for 3,000 rupees for the outfit. Prabhupada refused to pay it. He said, "I will not pay the tailor. I want the devotees to make the outfits themselves for the deities. And if there's any expense, you have to collect it." So when I remember when I first came here, of course we were preparing, Jamuna had given us 600 rupees to make a set of pajamas for all the deities. 600 rupees. We did it because we had to do it. So we were really working with practically no money to get the temple and all the deity paraphernalia together. So this went on. Let's see. I will go on to... All right. 3, 4... Just a second. We were going to prepare a book about the history of the Vrindavan temple. Maybe if you were present for Jaipataka Swami's lecture when he was here, he was talking about the importance of the history of the deities of each temple. So we had been talking about that, about making a history of our temple here, and we had broken it up into 6 different categories. We were going to do the history of Braj, because maybe some of you aren't aware, but many, many times temples were built here and destroyed by different invaders. For instance, the original Keshavji temple, it was 250 feet high, and it was destroyed by the Mohammedans. There were several temples built and destroyed, and the mosque that's still there was built over it. So we wanted to give a history of all the times the temples had been built here and all the endeavors to reestablish Krishna consciousness, for instance, by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then from the history of Braj, we wanted to explain Prabhupada in Braj, and then how Prabhupada envisioned his ISKCON Vrindavan. Originally, he wanted it to be at the Radha Damodar temple called the American House, but the Saivites at the Radha Damodar temple weren't agreeable, so therefore Prabhupada settled for this land. Then how Prabhupada struggled to establish the temple here, and then his instructions for the Krishna Balaram temple. Now that we have already done to some extent in the book Sri Vrindavan Dham As It Is. That was compiled specifically for those of you who plan to live here, because Prabhupada had a mood that he wanted for his devotees who lived here. He wanted us to live like Goswamis. He wanted us to do 8 hours of service a day. And he wanted the 24-hour kirtan to go on. Many instructions he gave us. He didn't want the women and children to live here. Only the women whose husbands were serving here. Things like that. So these cornerstones of how Prabhupada wanted the devotees to live were collected and put into that book, Sri Vrindavan Dham, as it is. Then, from those instructions, how our Krishna Balaram temple developed. From our first temple president, who was Subal. Now, for instance, the temple president Subal Swami, he was sent here by Prabhupada. He came for this world Sankirtan party. He was one of those four sannyasis who Prabhupada made. Most of you, I'm sure none of you know about him. Have any of you heard of Subal Swami? You have. Okay. Well, he came here, but he got entrapped by the allurement of Radhakund. And Prabhupada kept telling him, don't go to Radhakund, stay here, we have construction going on, I want you to oversee the construction. But he didn't listen to Prabhupada. So finally he went back to America and fell away from ISKCON. So this allurement and this trick of trying to snatch away Prabhupada's followers has been going on since the beginning of our attempts here to establish the temple. And that's why I noticed on the board 2 days ago Prabhupada's quote there, where Prabhupada warns the devotees not to associate with the Babaji's. You all saw that quote? Yes. Go look at the bulletin board. It's both in English and in Russian. So from day one, we've had this problem because the Babaji philosophy is very different from the Vaishnava philosophy given by Srila Prabhupada through the parampara that we come from. So how this development of the Krishna Balaram temple with its ups and downs, now we're on temple president number 26. That means in the last 36 years, we have had 26 temple presidents. All of the struggles, the challenges that they've had, the successes that they had in developing, how the land was all acquired. For instance, just today, some devotees came. They wanted to know where all of our Goshala land came from. Now, the Goshala land, for instance, yesterday we mentioned that there were 12 deities, and two of them were the mother cow and the baby cow. So in 1971, when Prabhupada first started the construction here after he first got the land, he told Gunarnava that he was very worried because we didn't have any milk. It was all buffalo milk. And there's no buffalo milk in the Western countries. There are no buffaloes in the Western countries. It's all cow milk. And the Western devotees couldn't digest buffalo milk. In fact, Prabhupada even said that of the three types of milk, cow, goat, and buffalo milk, goat milk is healthier than buffalo milk because buffalo milk is too rich and it makes you sick. So specifically, Prabhupada was concerned that his disciples weren't able to get any cow's milk and they were falling sick. So when Gunarnava understood that Prabhupada wanted the devotees to have cow's milk, he saved up some money and he bought two cows. Now those two cows used to live in the room where Janardhan lives now. That was our first Goshala. It's the first room there? Yeah. So that I was telling Akshay Gauranga that today. That was the first Goshala. They brought the two cows there. And the cows lived in the same room where they were keeping the busha. And one day the cows got loose and they ate up all the busha and they all got sick. They both got sick. So they realized they had to get more space for the cows. So in 1976, it all happened in 1976, one life member named Mr. Tapuria, He had, see, before in this area, this is where all the rich people lived. Everyone had their estates. Like the MVT used to be the Dalmia estate, and then next to that was the Somani estate, and this land over here was the Kadia estate. So, and these estates previously, these were all the gardens of the deities. For instance, where our MVT is, that used to be Gopinath's bagicha from the Radha Gopinath temple. And where Bibi Govinda Maharaj's house is, that whole area there, that was the Radharaman bagicha. So previously, all of Vrindavan was owned by their lordships, by the different deities of the temples. But as things weakened, the pujaris started selling off the different land. For instance, all of Seva Kunj belonged to the Radha Damodar temple. But the Goswami started selling off parcels of land until now it's just that one little temple courtyard and where the Rupa Goswami Samadhi and Bhajan Kutir are. So that's what happened here. And then after the independence, there was something called the sealing law, S-E-L-I-N-G, sealing, which translated to be stealing. So what the government did was, all of these temples that had huge amounts of land all over India, they said, and they would give it off to farmers, indentured, you know, the farmers to grow their crops, and then they would give tax to the deity. This was the system in India for thousands and thousands of years. So what the government did was they said that any farmers who were working on that land or anyone who had rented the land to build their house, that land now belonged to them and it didn't belong to the temples anymore. They were trying to reduce the property of the temples so that the people could have more land and the government could get more taxes from the people, things like that. So that's what happened here in Vrindavan. That the Gopinath bagicha, the Dalmias had rented some of that land, and when this sealing tax, sealing means it sealed off the parcels of land, when the sealing tax happened, the sealing act, the Dalmias got that land. And all the rich people got their estates around here, like the Danukas. They had that whole area. So they all got their properties then. And so the many rich people who didn't even live in Vrindavan had their homes here, their vacation homes. But they never came here, so the places were just in ruins. So one life member in Bombay named Mr. Tapuria, he had a rundown, beautiful home on the Parikrama path, and he decided to donate it to Prabhupada because none of his family was interested anymore in living in Vrindavan. So that's how we got our Goshala, the one that has the original Goshala where Sanak Sanatan and his family, that building, all live. So when we got that land, Prabhupada told Gunarnava to make the Goshala there. And he also told Dhananjaya, who was our president number two, he was our Grihastha president, he told Dhananjaya to go live there with his wife and family, and they should set up a Mukut business. So the Mukut business meant that, again, Prabhupada was establishing that he wanted the deities' outfits made by the devotees, not outside Mukutwalas. So we, as the ladies here at the temple, we all learned how to do the jari work. And we had tables, and we were making outfits for the deities. That was all going on over there. And Moksha Lakshmi, she's here today. She was too sick. She's coming. But She was too sick to speak yesterday. She was put in charge of that Mukut business. So we were doing that, and they were also getting orders from other temples around the world, and that was Prabhupada's plan. Prabhupada had a whole business plan for, like a master plan for this temple, how we would support the temple. He said there would be a Mukut business, and we would make outfits for all the deities all over the world. And Dhananjaya used to travel around and get orders from the different temples. And when Dhananjaya went to America one time, he happened to meet Bhaktisiddhanta and his wife, Vidya, and he encouraged them to come here, and that was how Bhaktisiddhanta came here in 1977. So later in 1976, Prabhupada had another plan. Now you'll see, when the Gurukula was built, Prabhupada had them build shops at the front of the Gurukula. He wanted the devotees to have shops with all of the things that people sell in Vrindavan. One shop would be for deities, one would be for musical instruments, one would be for tulsi beads. And he wanted the grihastas to run these shops, and the income would be both for the grihastas and to maintain the temple. So there's a... Now when you come here, we don't realize what the plan was, because it's not being used the way Prabhupada had designed it. But Prabhupada had plans for how the whole temple would be maintained. You understand? So he had instructed one devotee named Ananda Swarup from Italy to make deities, and they made samples of deities, and it was long discussion between Prabhupada and Dhananjaya and Anand Swarup what the deities would look like, how big they were. And Prabhupada wanted these deities different sizes, I think 6, 9 and 12 inches of Gornatai and Radha and Krishna, and he wanted them sold like dolls on Sankirtan. So that everyone, he said that just like they have, you know, like you go into people's houses, they've got all these knickknacks on their shelves. He wanted these dolls to be sold in all the households all over the world, so everyone would have Radha and Krishna and Gornatai in their houses like dolls, and eventually they would come to the platform of Krishna consciousness by looking at these dolls. So this was all Prabhupada's, his Sankirtan plan. Brass. Yeah, yeah, like deities. So he wanted that to be one of the businesses, and Prabhupada described it all in detail here in his room, how he wanted these different devotee businesses so the temple could be maintained and so that the grihastas could be maintained. They wouldn't have to depend on the temple. So the Goshala, the two cows, were brought over to the Taparia land. And then we had our guardian angel, that was Vishwambar Dayal, Bhagatji. He lived just around the corner. He took Gunarnava to Karnal in Haryana. That's where all the cows are purchased, you know. They do the breeding there. They got 10 more cows. And that way, they were able to finally get enough milk, at least for the deities, sweets and things like that. They used to bring the milk every morning and evening. We would make the Mangalarti sweets. And I used to make the Mangalarti sweets after the temple was first opened. The milk would come at 8 o'clock at night. It would take till 11 o'clock at night to finish the sweets. But what else could we do? So one night, Prabhupada saw the light on in the kitchen, and he asked Shruti Kirti, "Why is that light on?" So Shruti Kirti came over to the kitchen and he said, "Prabhupada wants to know what you're doing in here so late at night." And I said, "Well, I have to make the Mangalarti sweets at night. You know, the milk comes late." So when Prabhupada heard that I was cooking till 11 o'clock at night, he said that I had to be out of the kitchen by 9. So I didn't know what to do. So I told the temple president, I said, you know, I can't make the sweets in 1 hour. You had to make 6 different kinds of sweets. We had a very high standard Prabhupada gave us. We had to make kheer, sweet rice, rasgullas, sandesh, rubbery. I forget what else. There were 6 sweets we had to make every morning. Oh, and the deli sweet that had to be cooked, you know, put on every plate throughout the day. So they found someone else to make the sweets from that day onwards. And I made sure I had to listen to Prabhupada. I'd be out of the kitchen every night at 9. So the next morning, Prabhupada sent in a message. Because we would take the Mangalarti sweets, offer to the deities, and then get the Mahaprasadam and put that Mahaprasad onto Prabhupada's plate for his breakfast. So when Prabhupada got, I brought in Prabhupada's breakfast plate, as usual, and then he sent in a message, and he said, the message was, who cooked the Mangalarti sweets? So I said, now someone else is cooking, and then Prabhupada was happy, you know. So we finally had our cows, and it was at least enough for the deities to get milk, and Prabhupada got milk. Some for the devotees, but not enough. So then, as we all know, you start with 10 cows, but in order to get milk, you have to have baby cows. So now we have how many cows? 370? Yeah. 380 now. Yes. So that's in the span of 1976 to 2011. Well, Prabhupada only wanted 25 devotees here. He wanted 3 pujaris and 1 cook. And actually, somebody sent me yesterday the Vyasa Puja offering of 1986, and there were only 20 devotees on that list. I mean, not only was it very difficult to live here, and devotees didn't want to stay here, but Prabhupada didn't want a lot of devotees to stay here. He said only those devotees who could live like Goswamis. And that didn't mean that we were able to live like Goswamis, but we had to live. It was so austere here that you had to live like Goswamis. And not only that, we had very strict management at the time. Because Prabhupada had made those rules, the management enforced those rules. And the women, I remember when Prabhupada disappeared, Prabhupada's will, he had willed the executive power of Vrindavan Temple to 3 devotees, Gopal Krishna Maharaj, Guru Kripa Maharaj, and Akshay Nanda Maharaj, 3 sannyasis. Gopal Krishna was still a grihastha at the time. So Gopal Krishna Maharaj had been the GBC of all of India, and it was a little too much. So they broke up his responsibilities and they made Guru Kripa Swami the GBC for this temple because he had collected to build the temple. They thought, give him a chance. Now he was a strict sannyasi and his Namahata party were strict brahmacharis. So the first thing they did was they sent their temple commander. Some of you know him, Dhruv Maharaj? Yes. He was the temple commander. And in the middle of the night, it was the women's ashram here at the time, he knocked on every woman's door and he said, you have to be out of Vrindavan before Mangalarti. And they had to leave. All the women had to leave. Only 3 of us were allowed to stay because we were widowed. We didn't have our husbands, we were all in white and things like that. So they allowed three women to stay, the wife of the head pujari, the wife of a sannyasi, two wives of sannyasis, they had taken sannyas, so they were widows, and myself. That was 1978. So the management, they knew what Prabhupada wanted here, and they were enforcing it. So they had one cook that was Bibhu Chaitanya. They had three pujaris. Imagine just three. How many pujaris do we have now? 20? Three pujaris. Yeah. And 30 pujaris. Yeah, well. Prabhupada wanted three pujaris. Yeah, just one more zero, right?
Zero.
And we had a cook, and we had to run the restaurant, we had to run the guest house, we had to run the Gurukula with 25 devotees. And there were no Indian devotees at the time. It was all foreigners. And only one of them knew Hindi, Akshay Nandaswami. So there were challenges in the beginning, and we had to get through them, and we had to learn how to live here through all the austerities with no money and very little support. So when the devotees asked that we write this book, one devotee, Sitala Mataji, I was sending her this outline, how she could add to the book, because her husband, her first husband, was our first head pujari. That's Narottamananda. You all know Narottamananda? He comes here, he has long hair, and he sells incense. Yes, that's Narottamananda. So he was the first pujari here, and she would also come and go. Although she was mostly in Europe, because she got all of the deities made for the European temples. So she said that this is her addition to the book. Personally, I would like people to understand clearly how far Srila Prabhupada struggled for us. How radical it was for him to bring us mleches to India and allow Western Brahmins to worship on the altar, which had never been done in the history of this planet, as far as I know. Many devotees don't realize how revolutionary that was. The history of the caste-conscious Brahminical hegemony goes way back. Hegemony means battle, struggle. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's Parikrama party was stoned in Vrindavan. Did you know that? Simply because he gave Brahminical initiation to those not born in the Brahmin families. Also, Narottam Das Thakur and so many others had to confront these challenges. I don't think people realize what great power it took from Srila Prabhupada to break down the wall of these firmly held beliefs. So this is another point, that the risk that Prabhupada took to initiate mleches. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he took the risk of initiating non-Brahmins. But Prabhupada took it all the way to the furthest possible limits by initiating not only non-Brahmins, but mleches, and bringing them to Vrindavan and having them do deity worship here. Now, when Prabhupada was going to have the grand opening in 1974, he wrote to Gurudas, and Prabhupada's first idea was that we don't want any of the Goswamis to take part in the grand opening. We will do it ourselves. He said, we can invite them as guests, but we're going to do all of the ceremonies. When the grand opening finally happened on Ram Navami of 75, Prabhupada had changed his course of action. He decided to have them do it so that they would accept the temple. So over the course of 8 months, Prabhupada decided that better to include them in this temple. And also we had gotten some advice, some direction from the Radharamandir pujaris, because for four generations, Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and then even before that, the four generations of the Radharaman Goswamis had always supported the line of Vaishnavism, and they didn't stone the devotees of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. They allowed the devotees to come into the Radharaman temple. So Prabhupada said that we were allowed to take some advice from them for setting up our deity worship. So I've only done about 3 pages, but we can. If anyone has any questions on specific aspects of the temple, we can discuss that. Yes, Prabhu?
One question is that you were facing, all the devotees were staying there, were facing so many challenges.
Yes.
But consider, comparing to that, I am living in a kind of luxurious environment.
Yes.
So, am I not following Srila Prabhupada in terms of instructions, or if not, then why? How should I follow, and what else?
Well, what is your luxury?
We have all the electricity, 24 hour electricity, which is not even my home. Nice prasadam, everything nice is there.
Yes.
Even nice situation of senior devotees, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So, and not even real estate management, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So, those kind of challenges are not there.
Mm-hmm.
So, what kind of responsibility is for the new devotees to so that we can reach the program? And we fix and not deviating from the mood of the program.
Well, you can study the instructions that Prabhupada gave and try to carry them out. For instance, Prabhupada wanted the 24-hour kirtan. He wanted the goshala. He wanted the pujari department to be very strong. He wanted preaching all over. We had we have 3 states, Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, and UP. UP is the most populated area in the entire world. Did you know that? 1,100 people per square kilometer. So if you can help with the preaching in these 3 states, that would please Prabhupada very much. You have now the basic commodities are there. You have food, you have shelter, you don't get sick, you have good association. So now pick up, either by taking instruction from your spiritual master, or by going to the root instructions Prabhupada gave for this temple, and try to make those instructions your life. Just like what Iyengar did. Now, who was the originator of 24-hour kirtan? That was Srila Prabhupada. It was his desire. For some years it was non-existent. So one brahmachari, he took up that one instruction, made it his life and soul. So you can take up one instruction of Srila Prabhupada's, make that your life and soul, and make your life perfect that way. Which instruction, you might want to take advice from either your senior members here or from directly from your spiritual master. There might be something specific he wants you to do here. Something that Prabhupada asked him to do. I don't know. But even if you don't, we have so many instructions. Even if you pick up even one of them, Prabhupada wanted that every person who came to the temple to receive prasadam. Is that being carried out? So you can make that your life and soul. Pick any one of them. Yes.
What exactly?
Like the 6 Goswamis?
What is all yours?
Well, you read through that book, Sri Vrindavan Dham as it is, and you'll get some idea what it means to live like the Goswamis. Prabhupada gave some instruction there. Mostly it's a matter of consciousness. And that means giving up the desire for sense gratification. And it means serving, seeing yourself as the servant of their lordships here. That's what we are, that's what we are in the spiritual world, and this is our practice. Practical devotional service means we're practicing to go back to Godhead. Yes, Prabhu.
Do you know about one, like this is the example of all the other temples in the world, like running this temple to be the same for all temples?
Well, Vrindavan is special. It's the highest example. It should be the highest example of how our temple should be all over the world. But because of the special quality of being Vrindavan, it's just like the other temples are like embassies to this temple. For instance, if you go to the Australian embassy here, you'll feel like you're back in Australia. But it's just a little piece of Australia, you know, just a few hundred square meters. It's not the actual Australia. So this temple should be exemplary, and the other temples around the world are like embassies to Vrindavan. We do things a little differently that aren't done in the other temples. For instance, we sing Bibhavati Shesha, and we, like yesterday, there was a little controversy that Prabhupada had, according to the Shastra, on Ram Nomi we're supposed to fast from grains till evening time, but Prabhupada set a precedence that he made a grain feast at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so we've been doing that ever since. So who can break Prabhupada's precedence? Because he wanted prasadam to be distributed en masse on this, on that day. So we're doing like that. So there are, according to time and circumstances, slight differences.
You got an example of even the devotees, well, everything has to be offered to the deity.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the West, should we offer the offering everything to the deity? Like we're not always doing that, we just have to play with the picture of the general devotee prasadam.
I don't know. I don't know that he said that for all the temples. I know he said that for here. That's all.
This is like an example.
Yeah. And that would be a wonderful lifetime project to get.
The face of the temple or the scope of the temple has changed since so many years. Now, like at that time when the devotees were there, were only like 20 or 25 devotees. Now we have to cook for 300 or 400 devotees.
Yes.
So now, if that food has to be offered here, I mean, it becomes a little impractical in a sense, because the people who are engaged cannot maintain up to that high standard because all day they have to cook. And so how?
Well, we have 6 offerings a day. If you really wanted to do it, you could arrange for something to be put on the plate. You have to remember that in the very beginning, we didn't even have an initiated devotee cooking for the deities. I'll tell you that secretly. We didn't have a proper cook. So we had a Brahmin who was cooking in the restaurant. His name was Balaram. And he was a good cook. So Prabhupada had him come up and cook for the deities. He quickly initiated him. His name was Krishna Balaram Das. But sometimes in necessity, you can break one rule to follow another rule, in other words. For instance, if you feel that your cooks aren't qualified, then why are they cooking in the first place? So you have to bring them up to a standard where the prasad, where the bhoga is offerable. Otherwise, who are you going to offer it to anyway? It has to be to a proper standard. And certainly we have enough devotees here that there are enough Brahmins that they can at least be there to oversee the cooking. So this is a matter of bringing up the standard so that we... wouldn't it be wonderful if everything could go on their lordship's plates? It would help the consciousness of the entire community. So we can aim for that at least. Even the restaurant cooking, everything could go on the plate. At least on one plate. It can go on maybe Prabhupada's plate or the Samadhi plate, something. You just make one little katori of everything and put it on.
They wouldn't allow it.
Well, why wouldn't they allow?
Because the point is that when you have to cook for
300 devotees, it takes a lot of time. So not many Brahmin devotees would be coming forward to do the service of kitchen like that.
Why not?
A devotee kitchen I'm talking about.
Why not?
People, I don't know, I mean, up till now nobody has come forward.
Prabhupada didn't want any hired workers. We didn't have hired worker cooks. Yeah, see, the standard has gone down. There's quantity but not quality anymore. He didn't want hired workers, he didn't want hired cooks, he didn't want hired cleaners, nothing. With 300 devotees, you'd think you'd have, I mean, this is a managerial decision, but what are they all doing? If they can't cook, they can't clean, they, you know, what are they doing then?
10 years ago, they were all the devotees used to clean the temple.
Yes, of course.
I clean myself.
Yeah.
And then, about 2003 somewhere,
yeah.
Yeah.
The devotees did all the cleaning previously.
Old temple was being cleaned by them.
Yeah. We even had, at one point, we had devotee chokidars.
Chokidars.
There was no question of hired cooks and hired workers, and devotees had to do everything.
Not like a salary standards or something outside, you know, minimum wages and this type of thing.
Oh no, nothing. No such thing.
Now they have been trying to improve all those things.
Now, you have to remember that in Prabhupada's day, we had everybody had to have 8 hours of service.
Yeah.
That was the rule. Otherwise, we just couldn't stay here. You had to have 8 hours on a sheet of paper. I'm doing this much service. So there's no question of staying here then. That's how strict it was. Prabhupada didn't want loafers. He said, you know, this is not a free hotel for lazies and crazies. That's the way Prabhupada put it. Yeah.
But it is commonly given an argument
that if devotees don't hear and chant,
sit on the chairs. So, do we have a temple commander?
Now that has been abolished. There are only. I'm sitting in that office, but there is no anything like a temple commander. But I'm saying that.
Excuse me. You don't have a temple commander here? Yes, so we always had a temple commander. And that, according to the work that had to be done in the temple, the work would be, the service would be assigned to each of the devotees. And we just had to do it. That's all.
Normally now I'm hearing is that, if, let's suppose I can only talk about the brahmacharis. If brahmacharis are engaged for even 6 hours of service, then they say that we don't get time for hearing and chanting, and then they will not remain brahmacharis. They will fall down and things like that I'm hearing. No, but this is very serious stuff, because if devotees even do some six, I've been taking care of serving prasadam, and one time if it stretches for 1.5 hours, many times devotees, what to talk about serving prasadam, even that is seen as it's an extra service sometimes. I ask like that. So this is change of mood I'm seeing. The devotees are focusing on some extra hearing and chanting. I don't know, I'm just, these things are coming to my mind, I'm seeing it. My understanding is at least from 9 to 5 we should be serving. After 5 o'clock we come to Bhagavad Gita class or wherever some platform we have.
Sandwich.
So now 9 to 5, I'm not seeing other devotees are also like being properly engaged. So what is the standard, what is the instruction of Srila Prabhupada? Then if that is not followed, then I think there is something missing, because
instruction is 8 hours. Can't change that. That's what he instructed. You read it. He was very strict. Yes.
I remember how we had to, with our temple commanders, working with the Kriya,
you had to put in a, you had to fill in a form. You know, you had to fill in a, write in for, in 15-minute increments. You had to account for every 15 minutes of your day, and you weren't allowed to sleep for more than 6 hours a day. And they looked at your paper individually, and, you know, imagine, we were, you have to put in 15 minutes, I'm going to shower, and you had babies, man, you were, you had to put all this down on a piece of paper and hand it to the temple commander, and they came down hard on you.
Yeah.
You just couldn't, and that's just any other temple, it's not Vrindavan. Yeah. That's just, and you were talking about getting people to serve, Brahmins or things like cooking. I used to do the 4 o'clock offering in 74, 75. I wasn't even initiated, you know, but that's, I don't know why I was doing it, but I was. You know, just, you did what you had to do, and none of, I don't know this other, you just had to work from sunrise to sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how we were trained. It's different now. Yeah.
What is correct? That is my only question.
Correct is? Yeah, what Prabhupada, at least for this temple, I don't know about other temples, but you read, have you read Sri Vrindavan Dhamma as it is? You read that, and you write out all the amazing instructions Prabhupada gave for this temple. And you'll faint. When I had to go away, I was trying to get someone to replace me. And one Mataji said, I can only do 2 hours of service. The whole rest of the day, I have to read, I have to do this, I have to do that. 2 hours, that's the max. I couldn't believe it. So it's I couldn't believe it, because the training was so different that we received from Srila Prabhupada. Not that I can do it now, but in the early, I used to go out on Sankirtan at 6:20 in the morning and come back at 8:30 at night. And that was every day, every day. And we were just trained that way. No, I'd have to, because I'd be out on Sankirtan, I wouldn't hear the Bhagavatam class. I would sit down and read.
My main confusion is that Srila
Prabhupada has given instruction on the morning program emphasis.
Yes.
And the evening program.
Yes.
So my balance of understanding is that at least after 9 o'clock, engage in the service, 9 to 5 engage in the service, and then back to the evening program like that.
Well, it's not even 9, because prasadam's not over till 10. So 10 to 6, let's say. Right? Well, that's 8 hours. It's possible. And if you're engaged in deity service, that's an extra 2 hours in the morning, or cooking or things like that. You know, you have to serve according to necessity.
The problem happens that sometimes I like steam up for 8 hours, then I see that devotees are doing less, then I'm saying, I think maybe I should read more, then I could reduce less, and then again increase less, and then reduce less. So I'm not really fixed up. How many hours to fix myself up for that?
Well, as I said now about 5 times, Prabhupada wanted us to do 8 hours of service a day here. There are 24 hours in a day. So 8 hours of service, let's say 8 hours for your sleeping, bathing, you have another 8 hours for who knows what. Try it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you had to serve.
That's when you had trouble.
Great. Sure.
Try to impose this law. If you try to do these things in the temple now, then there is always some trouble.
That's so true. Yeah, because
you got used to some.
There'll be a revolution. At least we can individually set an example, and then and we'll see the change in our lives and also in our consciousness if we try to follow all the instructions Prabhupada gave for Vrindavan. We don't have to make everyone else do it, but at least individually we can do it and set the example.
I have a personal problem that I want to go to Gauravati. Many times when I go there, the whole atmosphere is so passionate that I don't feel like being in the part of that Arati. And then
I also feel that Srila Prabhupada has told us to come to Gauravati. Even in my college days, we were trained to come for Gauravati.
Yes.
So I always get confused that when some devotees are singing properly, then I feel like participating in it.
Yes.
But then when devotees are just passionately doing it.
Yes.
So there's a problem is now I'm confused to follow the instruction of Srila Prabhupada, and simultaneously I'm not feeling going into such a passionate kirtan. So that is a big problem. What should be done in that situation?
Well, another instruction that Prabhupada gave us was that we should also attend Raj Bhog Arti. So if that's not passionate, you can go to that one. And here now you have an option. You can also attend Gaur Arti at Prabhupada Samadhi, which is not quite so passionate. There are only about 3 or 4 devotees that attend every night. And aside from whoever it is that bangs the kartals, it's quite a nice arti. Maybe you could play the kartals at Prabhupada Samadhi arti.
You said interesting point that Prabhupada said that you should go for the Raj Bhog Arti.
Yes.
That's very interesting. So what do we do when we go for the Raj Bhog Arti? We, as the Nectar of Devotion says, that one should look at the deity with great devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. So when we go for the Raj Bhog Arti, we stand for the whole Arti and look at the deities and...
Well, you should be glorifying them by chanting also, singing. Singing, dancing.
Singing means loud singing.
Yes. Yeah, they have a kirtan going on, the Hare Krishna kirtan. We used to do the Bhog Arti, Baja Bhakata Vatsa, but that, for some reason, that was stopped. But we used to always sing that at Raj Bhog Arti. You know that song?
Yeah.
So I don't know why that stopped. Maybe because the 24-hour kirtan. Probably because the devotees stopped attending, so they just continued with the Hare Krishna kirtan. But we used to always sing here the Bhog Arti song at Raj Bhog time, and we used to always attend.
Just to ask a question that you were a few times. Prabhupada wanted that just to be the Hare Krishna mantra, or could it be other words?
It's supposed to be Hare Krishna mantra, yeah.
So I got in trouble the other day singing Jai.
Yeah, no, just Hare. Yeah,
food,
during the right, but. The 24-hour kirtan was Hare Krishna. Yeah. Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you.